You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this star time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Where Silence Has Lease. I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska.
The synopsis for tonight's show is, when an alien traps the Enterprise and threatens to kill half the crew purely out of curiosity, Captain Picard is faced with a grim decision. This is the second episode of Season 2 of Star Trek The Next Generation, and it was originally aired on the 28th of November, 1988. It was written by Jack B. Sowatz and directed by Winrich Colby. Tonight's guest stars include Dynamo Dow as Dr. Pulaski, Earl Bowen as Nagidum, Charles Douglas as Haskell, and Cole Meany as the still unnamed transporter chief, Miles Edward O'Brien. So, what did we think about this episode? Now, personally, I really like this episode. This is one of the shows that I have a very strong memory of when I was a little kid growing up watching this, probably not far off an original run. And watching back on it, I didn't think it I thought it held up pretty well. Now, how about you, Lou?
I'm going to pretend like this isn't the second time we're doing this review since the first one died off and say, what? I did not like it. I don't really care for it very much. So in this case, you don't have to remind me to go into the forums. Let's just go there now. I'm sorry. I shouldn't be like that. I really shouldn't be like that. But no, I'm just not too crazy about this whole episode. Nagilum. It wasn't quite the Terraformers. I wasn't quite that bored. One thing I would like to do maybe is if, spoiler alert, a third or a half of the crew is going to die, I'd like to pick out which third or half each person would be in. But anyway.
So do you think that when Picard was being faced with that decision, he was thinking, so Nagidum goes, I'm going to have to kill a third of your crew. And he's thinking, do I get to choose the third?
No. It would be Nagilum. So obviously Picard is dead, you know, and they're going to see how the boss will handle death. And so obviously Picard, Riker, Worf would probably die. Well, maybe not Worf because, you know, he doesn't care about death at all. He's looking forward to death as long as it's honorable.
I think Worf is out of the way straight away. I think he's being killed because I think that what Nagilum's after is for a variety of people to face death in different ways, and if there's one thing you know about Worf is that he's going to face it in a certain way.
True.
That is probably not going to be similar to anyone else on the ship.
That is so true.
In order to survive, you basically have to be a twin and be the lucky twin.
Could be. I was thinking, I think what Picard was probably more concerned with is that Wesley would survive and become the final ranking member and would be the next captain of the Enterprise. And if that's the case, then they're all doomed. So you might as well just kill them all off anyway. So James, before we get into the show or the forums, because usually you have to remind me every week, let's take a little bit and let's talk about what we've done over the last few weeks. I didn't want to do this last episode with the guest on, but I thought maybe in the second episode we could do that. What did you do over the 3-4 weeks we were gone?
To be honest, not a huge amount. I think that we've been week on, week off for the Battle Bridge since the beginning of the year, or more or less.
Yeah.
So it's kind of got into the groove. When we took a bit of a hiatus, it was a bit weird not having the stuff to come back to. So I, you know, it really was just a couple of weeks off. So I don't really have anything hugely interesting to say. Didn't go anywhere, still at work, plodding along, busy. My girl's going for exams, which has kept us busy as well. But I don't know. What about you, Lou?
Well, we mentioned this. I believe Alexa mentioned this when she talked to you, that she was planning to go to the One Direction concert in Chicago. And that's okay. What we did. We went on a nice little almost 1,500-mile road trip. And so the first thing we did, we left Omaha. We went up to Desmet, South Dakota, to visit a Little House on the Prairie exhibit. My wife loves the Laura Ingalls thing. And we went there a couple years back, 2-3 years, and she missed the final exhibit because I was just tired. I wanted to go. I had enough of these, and I just wanted to leave and go home. So she reluctantly agreed to let us skip it, which I wish she hadn't done. But so I made it up for her. We went back to that tour, and we actually completed the tour, and she got to see Pa's house, where Paul was born, or whatever the case may be. I don't know. I don't get into the stuff. But so she was happy that she got to see that. And then we got to see another exhibit in Desmet, South Dakota. Then from there, we went to Pepin, Wisconsin, where there was another exhibit going on, Little House on the Prairie stuff that she wanted to go to. From there, we went to Madison, Wisconsin, where we spent the night, and we went bowling. And I do have some video of us bowling, so it's kind of cute. Maybe I can try and dig that out. And then on to Chicago. Oh, goodness gracious. There, Chicago people have one form of communication with each other, and that's the use of the car horn. Because everywhere you go, there's taxis. There's the taxi to a person vehicle ratio is like 3-1. There's 3 taxis for every human's car. And so taxis all over the place. And what's funny is you drive down this big main stretch that they have that runs along their sea coast or whatever it is. And that's not the sea, but you know, they have a waterway this way and some boats all over the place. As you're driving down, you have taxis darting in, darting out. I had one taxi that I was next to and then behind for almost a mile. He'd speed up to a car that's in front of him and zip up in front of me and then go back over to the lane and then zip back over. And I'm like, this is getting pathetic. Honking, horns honking all over the place. We get to our hotel. Parking is across the street. It's $40 to park there. That's not something they told us. And it's some funky system. They actually valet in a 3-story build parking lot. My car was 5 deep. There were 5 cars in front of it. There were cars on each side of it parked everywhere up there. I don't know how they do it. But they had a system. So to get to my car, they would have had to pull 5 cars in out of there. So I'm not sure how it's done, but it was fascinating. They went to the One Direction concert. They walked there. And, of course, she said it was supposed to be done at 10. 10:30, I'm like, well, where are they? It's a mile away. They should have been home by now. 10:45, 11, 11:15, 11:30. I'm like, oh, my God, they're lost in Chicago. I can't go this place and get my car and go look for them. I don't even know where I'm going. Can't call the police. Hey, I'm missing my wife and daughter in downtown Chicago. So I was going absolutely nuts until I finally saw them walking down the street. Like, ah, thank God. So for that night, I spent watching Law & Order Criminal Intent. Have you ever seen that?
No, so I'm surprised. So you didn't go to the One Direction concert yourself?
Oh, hell no. There was no way I was going to do that.
Because over the last couple of weeks, I've just started assuming that you're just using your daughter as a front to get in to see Harry and whoever else these people are.
Niall and Liam and Louie, and I'm not sure. She knows them all. She knows where they're from. She knows how old they are. She knows who they're dating. She knows the tattoos on them. Yeah, she knows everything about One Direction, as you heard. From there, we went. Instead of going straight home, we actually went to visit a friend of mine who is a podcaster as well, Benjamin Straw. I don't know if you've ever heard that name before, but I went to meet him, actually. We were 20 minutes away from his house, and I mean, it would have been a sin to leave without visiting Ben, so I enjoyed that. And then we drove on home through a massive rainstorm in Iowa, of course. Yeah, we made it, and that was what we did. That was pretty much it.
That sounds cool.
Yeah. I'll never do that again. I don't want to go to Chicago. The only time I've ever been in Chicago is when I had to lay over in O'Hara, you know, land a plane, get on another plane, and take off to where I was finally going. But beyond that, I don't want to go back to Chicago. And I will never, ever, 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 for the life of me, ever go to New York.
Why not? What's wrong with New York?
It's the same thing as Chicago, only amplified by about 100.
I like New York.
Oh, you cannot drive in New York. You know, it just... That's why people don't drive in New York.
Yeah, you should just acknowledge that and don't attempt to drive. I mean, when you say New York, you mean like Manhattan, right? You mean
the whole
proper...
thing, all five boroughs. I would just stay away from them all. I have no desire to go to New York. You know, so... I mean, my parents, we used to drive to Fort Lauderdale, Florida for vacation. And along the way, you go through St. Louis, and my dad got lost in East St. Louis. And to you, that means nothing. But to everybody in the United States, understand St. Louis is one of the baddest parts of town. And if you go to – oh, anyway. I mean, he actually found a police officer who said, "What the hell are you doing here? You need to get the hell out of here." And so we got out as quickly as possible. But no, they're just parts of the world I'd rather stay away from. So,
is it really that bad?
Oh, it is. It is bad. It's just big and massive with so many millions of people. It's just, oh. You see television shows about New York. It's everything that they say it is. No place I'd rather be. No way. So, but that's that. What else was I going to say? I forgot. But that's that.
That's good. And by the way, when this hits, this will be the first day of Star Trek London, I believe.
Oh, yes.
If this is going to hit on the 3rd. And at this precise moment, depending on whether or not you picked it up, hopefully, I will be in the Wrath of Khan Q&A and show-in with Nicholas Meyer.
Oh, wow.
So that would be pretty cool if I managed to actually get round to booking my tickets for that.
I hope you can record some of that. Do you have are you allowed to bring a camcorder in?
No.
Phone? Anything? Speaking of which,
I'm pretty sure you're not.
I did ask you this question. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh,
I'm still here.
You know, when we get off the air, I would like to see if I can get a phone number for you.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know how to call, so obviously it may or may not work. But okay, so anyway, yeah, let's go ahead and let's get going. All right, we're good. So I'm going to hit stop. Oh, so let's go ahead and get on into the forums.
Did somebody say forum feedback?
Yes, I did. And we left off with episode 24 of season 1. And let me go to my notes here. We intentionally left off form for the premiere, The Child, because it wouldn't have worked by the time we would have been going to this year's forums. People wouldn't have had a chance to put down much information. So this will be our first forum feedback for the year. And we left off on, like I said, we'll always have Paris. We'll always have Paris.
Just one quick question, Lou, because I noticed that The Child hit earlier on this morning.
Mm-hmm.
How long was it in the end? What did we get it down to?
About 2 hours.
Because I was afraid that was going to come in over 2 hours.
It kind of sort of did.
And do you know what? I've got this premonition that I reckon that there's a chance that Elementary Dear Data might come in over 2 hours as well. I don't know. Just call me crazy, but I'm just thinking that it might.
Are you wanting me to keep this part in? Yeah. Or are you being serious? You're funny. You're funny. He knows something that you all don't know, y'all. He's funny. But I won't give any more information.
Okay. So let us hit the forum. So as we mentioned, we're on We'll Always Have Paris. And our first poster is from Kieran McDuff. So shout outs once again for Kieran for making it to the... making it first to the forum. And by the way, we are going to have to drag him onto the show, kick and scream in one way or another. Because he's, I mean, first of all, he's always active and also insightful in his comments. So let me just go through this. I was never entirely sure what was going on in this episode. The time loops I could just about deal with. Although I never could figure out why you'd repeat yourself and then notice that you'd done it. But when Picard, Riker, and Data ran into themselves in the turbo lift, I think even my brain melted. And I'm not usually too bad when it comes to temporal mechanics.
Okay.
What age? Go ahead.
I'm going to jump in real quick. And this is a discussion we did have last time we tried to record this. I think here's my thoughts on the time loops. The first time, summarize it and then detail. Summary, the closer we get to the source of the time distortion, the worse it's more felt. That's what they say in this, is it's becoming more pronounced. So in the beginning, it was more of a deja vu, and we just do it again. Captain, what was that? Now, obviously, if you've ever felt deja vu, it's exactly like that. Like, I've done this before. God, I'm almost feeling it right now. Because we've done this before, and we've talked about this before. But as you get closer to the source, that's when you can actually not only feel like you've done this before, you can see that you've done this before. And I think that's where it comes into.
Yep, I understand what you're saying. But it is strange that if you physically were to repeat time, if that is in any way possible, right, for a start. But if you were to repeat time, how would you feel about repeating time? Surely you're within the system, so you can't observe the fact that you're repeating time. I mean, it's a bit like I do really, really apologize for what I'm about to say here. But if you're suffering time dilation, either through going very fast or being in a gravity well, you don't feel yourself that you're suffering time dilation. It's only from an external observer that you notice it. And if you do have this hiccup in time, although it wasn't, it wasn't just a hiccup, right? It was more of a burp or whatever they wanted it to be. But if that did happen to you, if you're inside the system, then would you have noticed it? I don't know.
Yeah, well, have you ever felt deja vu before?
Yes, absolutely. And it is a bit weird, right? Because you don't really know. It's hard to explain. It's hard to explain whether or not you could ever physically feel deja vu from having actually repeated something within, within a time hiccup. Maybe I'm not explaining this well.
Well, because I was just thinking, how do we know that deja vu isn't something that we've repeated? I don't want to get too philosophical, but I have two potential death and reincarnation theories. One goes off of the movie Defending Your Life, where if you don't quite measure up, if your life wasn't as good as it should have been, if you weren't as brave or whatever, then you have to go back and live another life. It's a different life. But I was thinking, what if that was the case and we actually, when we die, we go back and do it all over again? That's one theory. We go back and do it all over again, which could explain some cases of deja vu. And I guess another thing is when you get those feelings of deja vu and you're just about to grab that hot iron in the wrong spot and you stop yourself, like I've done this before, what if you actually go and try and figure out a way or outside of the deja vu or do something different and just go ahead and grab that hot iron anyway? But it's like you'll never know if you had not grabbed it the first time and you're grabbing it the second time, right?
Yeah, I hear you.
So I wonder if there's a way, if it's true that we're reliving something, and that's why we feel a deja vu feeling of we've done this before, is there a way to break the cycle and do it differently? Second theory I have is death. I think, wouldn't it be interesting if when you die, let's say I did something stupid, like I saw a power line down on the ground, and I actually picked it up and touched it and electrocuted myself. I died. However, I go on to another, I guess, reality where I said, whoa, that was really stupid. I shouldn't have done that. And I continue on with my existence in another reality. Whereas in the past reality, when I died, everybody has been to my funeral and they've already grieved on me. My wife has gone on. My daughter's gone on. And you know what I'm saying? Or actually, that time, because if I'd done it, say, years and years ago, I wasn't married and I never had a kid. So in that reality, I'm already in the grave. But in my next reality, I go on. Now, let's say I have a massive heart attack tonight and I die. Well, I go on to another reality where the doctor says, boy, you really lucked out. You need to do something different. Whereas in the past reality, my wife is burying me next week. I mean, you know, Star Trek is what makes you think these things about could any of those be possible. So what do you think of those?
At this precise moment, I'm thinking that we're going to have a very similar discussion when we get to cause and effect.
Probably.
Because
that's a very good point.
To a very large extent, that's what I'm kind of flashing onto. I mean, first of all, cause and effect, and also then Tapestry, of course, yeah. Where Picard does get to the end, and then, well, he gets to interact with God, for want of a better word, and he gets to, you know, choose to come back or just, well, effectively, you know. By the way, tangent. Do you read Tapestry as Q having been there, or is it just all in Picard's imagination?
No, I don't think Q was there at the time, but I figure he can go back and see it all happen and just be invisible.
No, so what I mean is that does Picard die? Does he then have a discussion with Q? Does he then reassess his life, and then he's given the gift to come back to life? Or is it that all of this is in the mind of Picard as he is dying? So does Q actually come in and interact with Picard, or is it just Picard's imagination?
Actually, I was thinking deeper than that. I thought all reality suspended at that moment. Everything that, you know, Picard dying of or coming back to life or whatever, everything that occurred on the ship at the moment stopped while Picard and Q went on this little adventure. So I don't think he was actually dying or being saved. Everything just stopped.
Okay, yeah.
All hands abandon ship. Repeat, all hands abandon. When they were repeating their time loop over and over again until Data comes up with the number 3. So there's going to be an interesting one to do because every time you go through it, it's different. You know, the speech is different. The script is different.
Yeah, and certainly the kind of the sense of deja vu is just you kind of working your way through your life that, you know, you get a little bit of a, well, kind of like, you know, a two-day run-up to do the same thing again. And then if you fail, you get another two-day run-up to do the same thing again until you get enough, you know, enough intuition in order to be able to navigate whatever's going to be thrown at you.
Right. But I didn't, you know, I don't want to get ahead. I know it's late for you, but I didn't like the end when the Federation time base beacon was off. I thought there's no reason why the ship's computer would be any different than the Federation time base. The ship went back in time. The clock should have went back with them. But anyway, that's a different story.
Okay, let me get on to the current post. He said, what age was Janice supposed to be? If Picard had met her 20 years before, then I'd have to say she's pretty good looking for her age. I'm a terrible judge of age, right enough, but I'd have put her in her late 30s, so Picard must have met her as a teenager. Jean-Luc, you old sea dog. Mind you, when this episode aired, the actress who played her was 43, so even if her character was supposed to be the same age, she still would have only been 21. Given Picard would have been around 37 years of age, I'm still tipping my hat to him. Actually, I'm sure Dr. Crusher is about 20 years younger than Picard as well, so maybe it's just his thing.
And speaking of, We discussed that too.
At length.
We're not going to go into length this time, but since I lost my notes, I can't find. I did the math of how old Picard would be. Wasn't he in his 50s?
No, Picard wasn't. You mean now or
well,
before?
Okay. Let's see.
I think he's now expected to be in his 50s.
Well, because he was born on July 13th, 2305, and he took command of the Enterprise in 2364. So, but we're talking about when he was maybe on the Stargazer, or was that that was before he even went into Starfleet, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I think so, yeah.
Yes, okay. All right, so, yeah. He's probably right. You know, it's a good thing that recording killed out because I think I may have been wrong in my math all the way. So, go on.
Yes, well, speaking of Dr. Crusher, hey, look, we beamed someone directly to sickbay.
Yes.
Why didn't that work last week with Tasha Yard? That's weird. Come on, writers, this is the end of the first season. You should be ironing these things out by now. Anyway, as for the rest of the episode, I did like the ending with the three Datas. Again, it melted my brain a bit, but looked spectacular. And yes, I have to agree that it was great seeing Data actually take out the laser this time, rather than hide behind a closed door like earlier in the season. Mm-hmm. Overall, there's bits of this episode that have merit, but I'm not sure the whole story gels together in a satisfactory way. There's a story in there somewhere, but I'm not sure anyone is entirely sure what it is. I think ultimately the moral of the story is more never pass up a good thing than don't mess around with time gravity. Admittedly, the little bit of advice was done better in Starship Troopers, and Johnny Rico actually got some action with Dizzy Flores, thanks to it, whereas John Luke had the consolidation prize of a drink with Riker. Mind you, that might lead to the same thing. I'm sure anyone would pull in a bar with Riker as his wingman. Mm. Rating for this one, I'm with the doc, as with 2 out of 5. Going back to the feedback section, so we're getting now feedback for our feedback section, which is a little bit meta. There are only really two episodes I can think of from Voyager that were Klingon-oriented, and you mentioned them both. Prophecy is pretty poor, but Barge of the Dead is one that I used to think was poor before I listened to the Delta Quadrant review of it, and I have since come around to thinking how good it really is. So that's the one I'd suggest is better than Heart of Glory. Enough from me. May the Swartz be with you. And actually, one thing that I do have to say, I haven't seen Barge of the Dead for quite a while, and maybe it's something that I'll try to dig out, because I do remember being a bit meh about the episode, and not particularly. I mean, I didn't quite like it when Voyager tried to like integrate Alpha Quadrant like plots into their series, because it didn't quite. I mean, by the way, I'm not talking about things like Message in a Bottle where they go home or Pathfinder and stuff. That's all good, but when they had when they had a couple of Vulcan stories where the where Tuvok had a couple of flashbacks, and then they had other things with the Klingons, and certainly Prophecy, and I never really cared for them too much. But I mean, if it's been recently, if his eyes have been opened on that, maybe I should just look back and see if anything I missed, because it must be a good 5 years or so since I've watched that one.
Yeah, I remember adding like Barge of the Dead, and yeah, I don't even know if I've heard the Delta Quadrant about Barge of the Dead, so maybe I should listen to it and see. But if they liked it, I'm not sure how. Was Picard 57 years old during the series? Carnivore Jury wants to know. Okay, this one I'll go ahead and do the math for. Picard was born in 2305, took command of the Enterprise at 2364, so that would make him 59 years old. So, close. Oh, goodness. That's just what Kieran McDuff said, too.
Yeah, you're
we have not read the forums for a while, I guess. I'm sorry. Most sources I've seen have him born 2305, the first season, 2359, when he took command. Great. Putting the Paris no-show date 22 years earlier in 2342 when Picard was 37. All right, there we go. Ben,
I think we should pick up with Captain Proton, right?
Yes.
I don't think your average Star Trek moviegoer could tell you what episode they saw Geordi Vision in. Because of that, the movies had to be more accessible. As for watching the movies before the TV show, I did that as a kid with the original movies. And if you think about it, most fans bring their kids to the Star Trek movies. So movies need to work on a different than the TV shows if the majority of the audience is going to be entertained. This episode is the worst of season one. It is just so mediocre. Good podcast, guys. So okay. Thanks, Ben, for that.
Yes, and I'll mark you down for a 5 anyway.
Or maybe a 4.99999.
There you go. Carnivore J, I actually watched all the movies first, wasn't much of a fan of the series, and get this, my wife got me into it. Wow, that's a turnabout. Once I watched, I fell in love with it, and now she calls me a Star Trek nerd, a mantle I wear proudly. Point being, I would be one of those who would not have a clue about Geordi's visor. Okay, gotcha. So we got another Carnivore J. And this is about the episode now. I just watched the episode. Though been lurking here from this. Though been lurking in this post for a week. Creepy. I want to say Picard is a bossy. B-A-W-S-E. And we're no closer now to understanding what that means. As we were last time we recorded this. Yeah, but he does say, excuse my use of the urban American slang, but this guy is just so awesome. Even in season one, there could be no other term to fully encompass a level of progenous magnificence. Good. I said that right, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Progenous. Prodigious magnificence. Okay, now that I'm done with that bit of business, I have to agree with Ben. The episode itself is mediocre, but I still absolutely love it. I give it a 4 super awesome see through the menus. What does that mean?
That's what they were handed when they went to the Café du Paris something. They had futuristic menus. So Cafe. Instead of having paper, they had these like nice sheets of glass that. No doubt were like the iPad 15s or
yes.
Whatever.
Right. Yes, the completely implausible Café des Artistes.
It was des Artistes, of course.
You can't believe anything. It comes out of a Frenchman's mouth. Anyway, I would seriously hang out on the Enterprise D forever and be completely and blissfully happy. I agree. Keep up the great work, fellas. Loving the podcast. Glad we have more years together, and you have some heavy competition in the TNG podcast world since Mission Log just started doing TNG. I'm sure that you guys are up to the challenge. We'll bring your own wry, W-R-Y, not dry, D-R-Y, humor and wit to bear on remaining episodes. Thanks for all your hard work. And I did mention that, yes, at the time, I remember Galaxy Class came out a little bit before me. Before us, and it was about the time that I was going to start, and I said, oh crap, I can't start my show just at the same time Galaxy Class is starting their show, because people on Trekmate were actually talking about it. And so I decided, I need to give Galaxy Class a little berth, let them get a little ahead, and then we'll go ahead and do it. So that's when we started late. Now, Carnivore J, remind to self, you cannot add a comment while it's loading to interwebs. Do that before you hit send. I'm not sure what he means by that. Must have been a mistake.
You can't edit your comments. Once you put down your comment, if there's a mistake in your comment, you can't edit them anymore.
That's right.
You used to be able to.
That's right. You can only edit the main post if you do it, but not your comments.
Yeah, so, actually, that's right. If you own the post, if you own the section, you can change what people have written.
So I wonder what it is he wanted to change, because he doesn't say.
No, I don't think anything.
Okay, good.
It's just a reminder to self. He'll get it read out on the podcast in a couple of weeks' time. He'll remember.
Oh, yes, that's right. It's all good. I must remember that. Okay.
We also take birthday requests and congratulations to anyone getting married and things like that. Just send it in.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, just don't marry anybody like Keiko Ishikawa.
Whoa, 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 whoa. So we do seriously have issues that are going to be coming in a couple of years' time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we
are. I like Keiko. Keiko is wonderful.
When she was possessed by the Pawrites, maybe. Other than that, she's whiny and complainy.
So you think that she was easier to handle when she was possessed by the devil?
Oh, yeah, I liked it when she was possessed by the devil. She actually had some cojones. Other than that, she... And Miles! Oh, God, if I had to hear Miles in a whiny voice one more time. I'm surprised Molly didn't do it. Miles! Oh, anyway. Let's go back to where silence has lease. And it's spelled L-E-A-S-E, as in what you do when you're renting an apartment or something. You're signing a lease. So why didn't they name it where silence has leased? L-E-A-S-T. Typo? Or is there a meaning behind it?
No, I think there's meaning behind it. So this is where silence has the free run of the space that they inhabit. So this is where silence has authority, where silence has freedom. I interpret it that way.
Okay.
So it has, you know, where silence has its space thing.
So silence is the gov in this one, huh?
Yes, so this is silence as it has in the noun, the silence.
The silence is gov. And if you want an explanation of that, just wait till next week's show. Okay, so then we started out with, I said this last week, I'll say it again this week. What the hell? What the hell? Worf and Riker on the holodeck hunting. I mean, like I said, I think they're Baltic warriors. But what was the purpose? Now, I said, is this something like the Klingon's version of Pon Farr?
No, and I didn't. I still don't think so. I still hold to my view that I think this is what Worf does every morning as part of his normal exercise routine. He needs to, instead of going for a run or something like that, in order to stretch whatever kind of natural urges he has to go around and start murdering people wearing skull heads.
Right.
And the reason why Riker's there is because Worf thinks this is an appropriate thing to share with his boss.
Well, that makes... Okay, I understand what you're saying. But the exercise is over! So do you think the holodeck could have prevented Worf from killing Riker? Or do you think maybe... I mean, because he was using... Was he using holographic weapons? Or was those weapons from his quarters?
I think they were holographic weapons, but I still think that... Whenever they talk about the holodeck safeties, I always assume that that's what other people can do to you, so the holographic characters can do to you, rather than what two people can do to each other. Because, you know, realistically, you could kill someone by running into them very quickly and headbutt them if you happen to catch them at the wrong angle. So I'm sure that he could have killed him if he only had the foresight to follow through with it.
Yeah. So you're saying that a holodeck character can't kill Riker with the holographic weapon, but a real life person could kill Riker with the holographic weapon?
Yeah, that's what I would have thought. So I would have thought it's more along the lines of that within the holodeck, you get these things that are solid, and then if you whack someone with them, it's the same thing as whacking them with a solid thing. But the holodeck itself is not going to create a character that's going to come over and hit you with them.
Fascinating, because I always thought that any holographic thing cannot harm you whatsoever when you're on the holodeck. So, I mean, the knife in itself, the sword or whatever, as it's trying to go through Riker, it's not real, so therefore it would just kind of dissolve through his body and then end up on the other side. Now, a sword that Worf brings from his quarters, yes, that's real. Worf's real. Riker's real. That's going to hurt. But I still don't think a hologram can hurt you unless you have the safeties off. And they sure like doing that, don't they?
and I mean, this is Worf, right, going down to his holodeck. You know full well safeties are off. Worf's not a kind of guy that plays with safeties on.
You think so?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think he would not be able to relax if he felt that the safeties were on. I mean, even B'Elanna in Voyager would play with the safeties being off.
Yeah, but the captain was ready to confine her to a sick bay if she didn't stop that. You know, because she says, if I was to check, how many times were you running programs with the safeties off? I can't imagine Picard would say, yeah, go ahead.
I've always interpreted it as being like a Klingon thing, where the Klingons really do need the actual threat. You know, they do need it to be a real legitimate threat for them to feel that it's a, you know, it's a worthy exercise. They have to be able to have something at risk.
I kind of disagree. I think the Hirogens maybe. The Hirogens would need to have the real threat. But Klingon, no. It's just like watching TV, you know. They don't necessarily need to have the experience of dying to enjoy some entertainment. When they get to the real battle, that's a different story. Then they are looking forward to either winning or dying. But in the holodeck, I don't know if I'd want to be killed in the holodeck.
What? Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to be stronger. I'm going to give you a stronger statement than that. I don't want to be killed in the holodeck.
No. So I don't think can't imagine. Okay, let's put it this way. Let's say that the Worf did have the holo safeties off. Do you think he's actually going to get into Stovacor because a fake Baltic warrior killed him?
Oh, actually, I think that's one of the best arguments then against it, because you would end up dying effectively through a training accident, right? Now, there's is no that honorable? No, I don't think there is.
So, I would say that in that case, Worf probably would be happy with keeping the safeties on so he can live to defend the Empire another day.
I mean, if anything, you know, with all of this stuff about people meeting an honorable death, there's no real reason for them to train hard at all, right? You go into battle, if you die, you've got an honorable death. If you don't, then you live another day to die an honorable death.
No, I don't think so. I think that if you were to just lay down and die, or you didn't give your 110%, that's not very honorable. So you have to practice to be able to give that 110%. If you just give 80%, I don't think that's good enough. I don't know. It's an interesting question. Interesting debate. We could probably go on all night.
But we do have an episode to do.
Yes. And, you know, and it is.
And we're at the teaser.
Yeah, we're at the teaser, yes. And it's like 10:30 your time. And I actually, you know, I'm sitting here thinking that I could get my wife to the bingo hall in less than an hour. So I'm thinking, oh boy, we may have come to a point where we have to stop and come back. But anyway, an area of blackness appears and disappears in no predictable pattern. As if there were any ordinary hole in space, wouldn't we be able to see what's behind it? Or could we? And I did ask you, could we see what's behind it? And you kind of chuckled and said, what?
I can't remember what I said, to be honest. But I think this entire thing is stupid about a hole. I mean, what exactly do you mean by a hole? If it's a hole as in it's going somewhere else, then you wouldn't be able to see through a hole. But the fact that you've even noticed that it's a hole itself is a bit weird. So I don't know. I find this a bit weird. And in particular, but you know, when we did cover this last time, and I also then, after we had a chat, I then went and checked, and I am correct. When Data mentions that they've never encountered anything like this before, and no one's encountered anything similar to this, they clearly haven't watched, is it season 2 of the original series? Because in the Immunity Syndrome, they find a big black hole, they fall into the big black hole, and there's a threat inside the big black hole. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty similar to what goes on here.
Yep. So, yeah, Data was, he was just a wee bit off. There's some history that he hasn't absorbed. Speaking of ancient history, I know there was a time when men thought the world was flat and the sun revolved around it. Matter of fact, if I remember correctly, the Catholic Church would kill anybody who believed that the sun didn't revolve around the earth. Let's see. Or if the ship sailed too far out of the ocean, would fall off the edge of the world, huh? But I didn't understand the beyond this place be dragons. And I don't remember what you said, if you said anything about that. So what was up with the dragons?
I don't know. I don't know what it specifically references. I assume it's just somewhere off the chart where there's a, you know, where there are dragons. I don't have much better than that. Or at least places where you do want to go.
Yeah. And the final one was how captains were hanged from the yard or when they refused to turn back. All I got to say to that is the movie The Perfect Storm. Have you seen that one with George Clooney?
No, yeah, I have. I have.
Okay, so there you go. He refused to turn back until it was too late and the entire ship perished.
And considering that, you know, Worf is just standing behind Captain Picard at this point, and he's had, you know, he's had his early morning exercise in the holodeck, I suspect that he's up for hanging a couple of captains if he goes into this big black hole of nastiness, because Worf at this point is pretty spooked by it.
Oh, yeah.
There are some Klingon legends that suggest that he's got. Well, he's on edge, at least. We'll say that.
Oh, yeah, he wanted to fire a torpedo, didn't he?
Yes, he did, and he suddenly came up with a yellow alert, and he kind of gets pushed back on the yellow alert, and I thought that it was a perfectly reasonable thing for people to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, they go up against this big black hole that's in space that they don't really know about. They start firing... firing probes into it. The probe kind of gets to a certain point and disappears. Mm-hmm. They then think that the best way to solve that is then fire a more expensive probe into it with a full a full array that disappears. And then after those two have fallen in, I do like it that Worf's position is, well, if probes didn't disappear, let's see what photon torpedoes do. And I do have I like the idea of Worf just sitting there firing whatever he has into this hole until he's satisfied that it's no longer a threat.
You know, you said this last week, last time we've tried to record this, and I didn't challenge you on it, and I actually want to do it this time. What do you mean by a more expensive probe? I mean, if it was by our terms, if we were to buy all the technology needed to upgrade the probe, it would be more expensive, but they have these probes that are just sitting around.
Oh, I mean, they send the first probe they send in is a standard class probe. I don't know what they refer to it as. Mm-hmm. But then when they send the second one, they give it a full array, a sensor array. And they right. basically load it up with more and more technology.
So I'm just
telling them it's a higher spec probe.
Right, so I'm curious, why do they even have different classes of probes? Just keep one probe in the ship, and that's the best one you can get. You can replicate all the material you need for it. Just make it all a class one probe with full sensors. Even give it warp drive if you want. But, I mean, yeah, I don't understand the different probes.
Right. So, I mean, I suppose you'd have a different probe if there was a trade-off, right? Mm-hmm. So if you traded off armor against maneuverability or sensors against... against how long it's going to be able to survive a lot in a gas giant or something like that.
Mm.
So to the extent that you couldn't have it be the best in every area, you might have several probes that are, this probe is particularly well suited for this type of job.
That makes sense. That makes perfect sense. Okay, so we're trying to get a better, closer look at this thing, but we're just not doing any good until, even the super specialist comes aboard the bridge to try and... We're talking about Pulaski. I'm not a bridge officer, but... And Picard actually steps aside, and she takes his spot and says, "Magnify to 1,000, Mr. Data. To 10,000! And of course, this is again where she just pisses me off. It does know how to do these things. I can't imagine that Gene Roddenberry... actually wanted Pulaski to have this kind of an attitude towards Data.
No, I agree. Okay, if we're going to get on to Pulaski, I don't particularly mind Pulaski in general, but I really don't like the relationship and the interactions he has with Data. And the stuff that, I am repeating myself for Lou because we had a chat about this last time. But what they're trying to go ahead and what they're trying to do here is they're trying to introduce the same kind of conflict that existed with, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. In particular, the Kirk, so the Spock and McCoy axis. Now, in my opinion, if they identified that and used that as a jumping off point, they really missed really what was the whole point behind the Spock to McCoy. So in my mind, Spock and McCoy were always, or at least they were allowing, the arguments that they had allowed Kirk to play out the arguments in his own head in a way. So, you know, McCoy was the more emotional side, Spock was the more logical side, and you could even consider Spock and McCoy to be, you know, standard bearers of those type of ways of solving the problems, which then allowed Kirk to reach a conclusion going through the middle, and that's why Kirk was the captain, because he was the perfect blend of the McCoy and then the Spock kind of Spock persona. Now, the problem we have with Pulaski is that Pulaski doesn't play off Data in the same way. So it's just a one-way kind of a torrent of abuse here instead. So it's not that Picard is leaning on either Pulaski or Data. That relationship doesn't exist. The other thing that I didn't mention is that Spock and McCoy, in my mind at least, they always chose their sides, and they were always prepared to debate from their own sides, and they were always people that would probably stand in as equivalents on either side of an argument, in a similar way that you'd have on either side of a political argument, and there was like a mutual respect potentially there, whilst being completely sure that your way was the way that, you know, you would want to argue for. Whereas with Pulaski, you don't have two equals. With Pulaski and Data, you basically have Pulaski, who is deciding to go after and to bully the Data character, which at this stage is very much a childlike, innocent character. Mm-hmm. And instead of it being two people fighting on the same terms, it's kind of a bully going up to an autistic kid and saying, why are you such a nerd? And that's what I really didn't like about the Pulaski-Data relationship.
Right. Okay, so I'm going to get you on a tangent again and start you off.
Go ahead.
Could the lack of a dimension be a dimension in itself?
No, it can't.
Right. So we have dimension and we have no dimension. Okay. You're not going to go into it any further, huh?
No, I mean, that part of it was a little bit silly. And that's trying to be what's it? They're trying to be clever and almost philosophical. But I don't think they quite work. By the way, we didn't even mention the fact that this, you know, they go up to the hole, right?
Yeah.
And they play around with the hole. They fall into the hole. So we've not mentioned they fall into the hole. And I don't know about you, Lou, but I didn't see that coming. I mean, they crept up to the hole, they poked the hole, they had a chance to leave, and then they fell in. I did not see that coming at all.
And see, like I said last time, they didn't fall in the hole. The hole fell on them. The hole just came up and swallowed them. Just all of a sudden enveloped them. So, I mean, they weren't moving. The hole, and you could see on the screen, the hole just came up and got them. So, anyway. So if the ship is really moving inside the void, why would the view screen still show the same image? And what I speculated was it didn't, but it's Nagi them making them believe that it's the same image just to mess with their minds.
And I think my theory here, I mean, I think that's perfectly valid. My theory here is I think they're also trying to portray like the infinite nothingness that exists out there. So the idea that there's something so vast that you just simply can't, that there's no sense of scale. So you can't zoom in on anything, because 100 times closer to it, you're still at the same distance, because it's just so infinitely vast that you can't do much. But by the way, if it was infinitely vast, then you wouldn't have detail in the view screen. You do actually have detail in the view screen, which means there are differences between the patch on the left and the patch on the right.
Right.
And as soon as you have that, then when you do zoom in, you should be able to see that has shifted.
Yes.
So... but I think that's what they were... I kind of read it as that's what they were trying to go for.
And just didn't think of it very much. Okay, engineering, transfer to bridge. And this is the first time we actually see anybody transfer engineering to the bridge. And I said my reason was obviously they didn't want to get LeVar Burton out of the whole mix and just bring him on once in a while. That's what the drop-in chief engineer was for. So they want to bring him back on the bridge. And so best way to do that is transfer engineering to the bridge. And obviously it's LaForge's Team Viewer that I use a lot. I use Team Viewer to log into computers a lot. So whatever he sees in his office, he can do from the bridge. You agree?
Yes, and I think it's actually a quite clever idea because, I mean, up until last week, I suppose, there wasn't a huge amount of action in engineering. And now they're trying to now with the main character going down to engineering, I suppose one threat that you have is that the engineer is always out of the way and doing whatever he needs to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I seem to remember that Scotty didn't spend a huge amount of, when he was down in engineering, there wasn't really the set wasn't as impressive, of course, but it kind of always seemed like he was just out of the way doing busy work. So I think in order to prevent the loss of LeVar Burton being integral, I think this is a clever idea that allows him. It basically gives you the best of both worlds to borrow a title. You can have him downstairs when necessary, but you don't necessarily have to. You don't need to lose him from the bridge and the impending developments. And from a perspective of the actual how the ship would run in universe, it kind of makes sense for the chief engineer to be at least involved and at the front end of. When there's an emergency, he can see how things are going to develop. He can be there to give feedback quicker.
Mm-hmm. But he still has to request permission to leave the bridge. And if I seem to remember, Scotty did spend a lot of time on the bridge because he had his engineering station right there on the bridge as well. I mean, right off the turbo lift, you take a right, you got Uhura, you take a left, you got Scotty.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. Let's see, what else? Romulan Warbird comes out of nowhere, which they almost beat the bat crap out of the ship until we fire back. I mean, one torpedo, and bam, we obliterate the Warbird. No dead Romulans floating, no dogs, whatever the dog equivalent of the Romulan it would be. That was just too easy. And then we get the USS Yamato, the Enterprise's sister ship, also comes out of nowhere.
It's a bit strange. I mean, the Romulans do appear for absolutely no reason and then disappear. And I think that within the production universe, it's only a couple of episodes ago they introduced this new cool new ship with a potential new enemy coming along. So it's it's good to use them. They do appear and then bang and then they disappear. And if you're not careful, you can miss the Romulan kind of connection to this. To this episode, although I think that it's not supposed to be the Romulans, it's merely Nagirum who is yet to appear playing mm-hmm. with them.
Playing with them big time.
I mean, as is, of course, the Yamato itself.
Keep the cheese, I just want out of the trap. That's pretty good.
Actually, when was that mentioned? Because I thought Geordi, I don't quite know exactly when it's mentioned, but Geordi does mention, keep the cheese,
just before they board the Yamato.
Because I think that Geordi, when he mentions that, because in my mind, that tells me that Geordi is way ahead of the game here.
Yeah.
He knows that this is a game that he's playing. He knows, or at least it appears that he knows that, or either that or he's guessing and it's just a lucky guess. But to me, that was a very, to me, he was almost Geordi cottoned on too early that this was, they were being toyed with. And and that doesn't necessarily didn't necessarily get picked up by senior members.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, they did attempt to try and get out several times, and they saw, Starfix, and there's nothing there. There's another Starfix. Well, now it's gone, and I think everyone could see that they were trapped in some way, and I think that's where the thing came out of. I don't necessarily believe that it was revealing. I know more than. Or I think I know more, or he did know more, or something. But we have the Yamato, and so Riker and Worf decide to board it. But it's empty. And also they find that nothing's in its right place. It's got two bridges. Every time you walk out one door of the bridge, you come into the other side of the bridge. And, you can hear, as they walk around, they can hear Riker can hear Worf screaming, and he goes running to find Worf saying, "I heard you screaming." And yeah, so it's, you know, it's time to get back to the ship, but of course that can't happen either.
Actually, by the way, one thing I should say that I mean, I think, you know, I kind of have a fun about the how the episode goes and how the threat is put there, but I think it's actually, I think it's quite effective how kind of spooky all of this is. I think the score does a very good job of that. And at this point, you're kind of thinking, you know, really, what on earth is going on? There's a hole they've fallen into. There's weird stuff with the Romulans. You're now on another ship, and you really don't know what's, you know, what is up here. If you had to try to explain these things outside of this basically being a test for the crew, then it would be very difficult to explain why they're coming across these you know, weird artifacts. So I'm actually, you know, at this point, I'm interested in what's going on, and I'm pretty kind of spooked. Yes. I think the music is pretty spooky, and we get the kind of the reveal come up in a second when the main antagonist appears. And again, when that happens, it's just really weird, right? It's, you know, you wouldn't have, I don't think, you know, 5 seconds before he appears, if you asked 20 people or so, hey, what happens next? No one's going to say, you know, a weird kind of baby-faced nebula monster appears, right, on the view screen.
You know, I saw a potential glitch, and I need you to confirm this for me. On the Yamato, that I think Riker and maybe Worf should have detected at some point. On later on, we actually see Captain Donald Varley of the USS Yamato, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the tactical station there, it was actually green, wasn't it?
Oh, I don't recall.
I'm thinking it was, because it's set aside from the Enterprise's tactical station. However, in this episode, where Silence has Lease, when they go aboard what they think is a Yamato, it's just a standard wood color tactical, just like the Enterprise. So it made me wonder if they were actually even aboard anywhere else, or were they actually aboard the Enterprise? Which is why it would make sense that tactical position was wrong. It's like Picard and the crew were on the Enterprise, and Worf and Riker were still on the Enterprise, but in a different dimension, and which is why they couldn't see each other. And then Nagilam, or maybe a holodeck where Nagilam is moving things around. That's kind of what I thought. Two bridges.
No, and also it's not just that there are two bridges, right, or the bridge is in the wrong place. Mm-hmm. There's the bit where Worf walks through the door and ends up on the other side of the bridge. So it's clear that it's not that there's just something weird. It's that someone's playing with the reality and the physical kind of laws here. So I do think it is. I put this after Nagin kind of presents himself. I just put this down to him kind of completely, you know, playing around and having power beyond, you know, beyond what we know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Yeah, because I wonder what would happen if, you know, when Worf could see Riker here and Worf could see Riker there. It's, you know, what would happen if Riker walked toward one of them? It's really kind of strange, but this is a pretty good, interesting thing there. So anyway, we return to the Enterprise. To see Wesley is either in the restroom or maybe doing something else. But anyway, another ensign is finally getting some time on the con. And, of course, that poor guy's wearing a red shirt. Wesley, go down to engineering and just sit in the corner. You don't want to be here for this. Right?
Yeah, I mean it's so blatant, right? That they need to get Wesley out of his station, so that they can kill someone. You wonder why they didn't just kill someone else on the bridge. I mean, you could just have an ensign on the bridge just walking by. But I mean, you know, as the guy dies, he's quite shocked and you know, does a over the top performance.
Oh yeah, he was terrified, obviously terrified. But and then we see Worf in a battle a no-holds-barred battle with the turbo lift doors. I wonder what he was saying. I wonder what those Klingon curse words were. But Riker has a poem back. And again, for the second time in this episode, it looked like Worf was about to kill Commander Riker.
At ease, at ease, Lieutenant. At ease.
All right. So anyway, the Starfix. We already discussed that, you know, there's a Starfix. Well, now let it go. Let it go. You can only pull me a couple times.
Yeah, I didn't think they caught on particularly quickly. They seem to, you know, they seem to be fooled more times than that I would have thought they would or they should.
Right. So we have the voice of Nagilum. And I'm still thinking that this is the same guy who plays Rolf Alfenhaus in the Neutral Zone. Or do you think?
Let me see. There's only one way to find out, but I didn't think so. I think.
Let's see. Who is.
So which one was Rolf Offenhaus?
Offenhaus.
The corporate dude.
Yes, yeah. He wanted his lawyer. Well, they have Earl Bean as Nagilum, or Bone as Nagilum, but let me see if it's uncredited. So what I want to know is the voice of Nagilum. It's not even in the uncredited part, so fascinating why they wouldn't have the... Unless it was Earl Bone that did the voice as Nagilum. I thought for sure it was the guy who played Rolf Alfenhaus. Earl Bowen. Okay, it must be Earl Bean. Fascinating. Okay, cool. Well, let's go back. What do you think of the Pulaski dance to all the way to the back wall?
Oh, even when she was being moved by Nagidum. Not the greatest thing in the world.
I was just wondering what he was doing to her, maybe tickling her in some way. Man.
I mean, I would imagine if they were doing that. You know, nowadays it would have been you know, instead of relying on the actress to like walk backwards in a funny voice, in a funny way, they would have probably had a physical effect of her being thrown against the against a wall or something.
Right. Okay, so he wants a demonstration of how we propagate our species. Too bad Wesley's not on the bridge. You know, he would love to have been involved in that.
I'm surprised that Riker wasn't up for that. I don't know.
Yeah, Captain, I'll bite the bullet for this one.
Yeah, I've got this. I've got this.
Yeah. There has to be a female ensign somewhere on the bridge at the time. You over there, come here. Let's show them while it's done. And then, of course, we get the cheesy porno music going.
You see, this is how the episode should have ended. You know, Riker should have taken control at that point. He could have got down to a bit of action, and Nagidum would have been so disgusted that the Enterprise would be jettisoned at like warp 7 or so. Just spat out.
And see, while you're doing that, I think I'm gonna, while you said that, what Riker's doing, I think I'm gonna put on a little Barry White music. Keep on doing it. Right on. Anyway, that's enough of that. Okay, so you exist and then you cease to exist. Your mind calls it death. At this point, I'm like, oh my god, this is amped it up. Because then we see poor Haskell. He's finally got some bridge time in, only to writhe in pain and dies in the fetal position. Oh, Wesley, what you do to us? So much promise, but yet no payoff. Okay, now let's spend a few minutes talking about a nice little moral debate here. Nagidum is going to perform an experiment on the crew that will result in the death of one-third of the crew, maybe half. Question is 30 to 50% casualties really within acceptable limits? does it make sense that Picard would destroy 100% of the crew so that the remaining 50 to 70% of the crew that survives doesn't feel guilty? I do kind of have a problem with Picard's logic. Yes, fight to the death, but don't just kill yourself. What do you think?
Well, one thing though, which you can't discount, right, is the fact that through Picard's actions, he actually managed to save everyone. So The fact that he effectively called the bluff, potentially either called the bluff or got to the point where Nagidim acknowledged that there was nothing that he could learn from this because, you know, Picard was willing just to blow everyone up and, you know, he wasn't prepared to either let that happen or wasn't interested in seeing it happen.
Or like he says, I have seen all that I need to see, because not only he wanted to see how they would face death, he was gonna see how 300 to almost 600 people are gonna see death. Instead, he got to see, because they were all going to die, well over 1,000 people, he got to see how every single one of them was building up to face their death. So I think he got more than he really needed to, he was looking for.
But I suppose, I think in the episode, at least I took away that I assumed that he would want to see kind of the final act. So not just the preparation for death, but the actual death itself, the, you know, seconds leading up to it and the inevitability of the event. But getting back to your original point is that, would you accept one casualty in order to save, you know, the rest of the ship? So if he were to say, look, I'm going to kill one member of your crew at random, would Picard be happy with that? And I think in the past we've seen instances where effectively the captain would volunteer for that. Because what we're talking about here is we're just talking about a suicide mission. Archer did that when blowing up the sphere, and I'm sure there are other instances where people effectively volunteer for a one-way mission. So you'd almost see that people being willing to take that, as you know, take the bullet, as it were. Now, on the other extreme, would the captain allow, if the Gideon asked for like everyone else, 999? People to die and only one to survive, would Picard allow that? And I think at that kind of level you wouldn't. So there's obviously some kind of crossing point, and you know, Picard's acting in the point at the stage where he thinks that, you know, 30% is too many. I'm assuming he would probably have the same opinion with it being, you know, 20% or 10% even. But I do think it's an interesting interesting discussion. And from Worf's perspective, he does come from a kind of like a military background, or he's thinking in military terms, which is much more that if you do have soldiers, if you do have, you know, a battlefield, in order to achieve your objective, you're not going to achieve it without losing a man.
Right.
And at a certain point, if you're going to lose, then okay, is it any different to lose 10% through battle than 10% through random chance? I think actually, to be honest with you, it is, because at least when you're in battle, there's a false sense of control of your own destiny, but I think that does play a part. So it's, whilst you're in control, whilst you're actually on the field doing what you need to do, you might think that you have a better chance than average, whereas if it's just a luck of the draw, then I think it is the loss of control that each individual has. Maybe that's the issue.
So then during the Dominion War, when I'm sure we lost at least a third of the fleet, the rest should have just all committed suicide. If some of us is going to die, we might as well just all die. I mean, obviously, that's what you say. It's a difference if you're in a battle and you have a chance of survival, but to just sit back and wonder who's going to be the one chosen, I guess you would just rather fight your way out.
Yeah, it is.
All right, because then I wondered, you know, while they're in the briefing room discussing this, you know, why didn't Nagidim start his experiment already? You know, what was he waiting for? He allowed for the briefing, the visits to engineering, the whole countdown to destruction. Nice little music in the captain's quarters. The debate in there about, I mean, obviously he was in command of, he was in creating that situation with Data and Deanna.
And actually, by the way, one thing that you do have specifically on this ship, you do have a chain of command, which means that Picard is able to make this choice and stand relatively strong. So let's just assume he's got this moral position or this even philosophical position that allows him to say, look, no, we're not going to be bullied for this. How far down the chain of command do you have to go before people don't have that discipline anymore? So if you removed all of the bridge staff, which is, you know, 11 people or so, and then said to the rest of the crew, hey, we're going to come after a third of you, would they have been as stoic as Picard is, and would they have held the line?
No.
Or at that point they would have said, hey, actually, yeah, you know, 2/3 chance of survival, I'll take it.
Yeah, take a chance. And then, you know, they have to sit there and wonder how they're going to die, too. If it was like Haskell, I'm not so sure I'm up for that. You know, another interesting question, and this is a complete tangent because I think we need to go on, but what if Captain Picard set the auto-destruct in engineering and then made his way toward the bridge but didn't make it and he died along the way for whatever reason? Maybe he tripped and fell and hit his head and he died, and obviously everyone's safe, so Riker gets to the bridge without the captain and there's no one to shut off the auto-destruct now.
I think I think that's a shortfall of the design of the auto-destruct.
Yes.
I think at that point you're going to have to very quickly go to shuttle to the life rafts and escape pods.
The pianos, I call them pianos.
You mean from First Contact?
Yes, yeah, they look like pianos to me.
No, they do. They do.
Okay, so Troy and Data come to Picard's quarters and tell him that he's wrong to destroy the ship. We already discussed this. But, you know, I did like Picard's explanation of death. It was a very interesting theory. And, see, I'm forgetting. When did I just... when I talked about my idea of death, which you... Deja vu. It was a deja vu, so that would be the next one, wouldn't it? Oh, no.
No. You discussed that earlier in this episode.
Oh yeah, for We'll Always Have Paris. Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. So now you know. You all know what my idea is.
So if you watch the episode, you have Picard's interpretation of what death is, and you'll also have Lou's.
Yes.
As well.
You have a couple theories. Okay. So I guess Nagilim had enough of playing with the crew and let him go. Auto-destruct all the way to the last second. And I like the Riker. Yes, I do. Wholeheartedly agree. Simple yes would suffice, number one. Oh, and look! Wesley's back on the bridge.
And the chair is still warm.
Yes.
And he's gone back to his old station.
Yes.
Guys, thanks for covering.
For all we know, we don't see the floor. The guy could still be laying there, for all we know. In his fetal position.
Just out of shot. They haven't taken him down to the air.
Data, when are they going to move this stiff? Anyway, Picard and Nagilim give their goodbyes by Picard saying, next time, maybe they should meet out here among the stars. That would have been interesting, you know. Have Nagilim come back once in a while, just like Q.
Well, thanks. I don't get the impression that I know what or who Nagilim is, right? I mean, is it the whole sex, you know, the whole thing that was in space that sucked them in, or is he someone that lives in there, or I just didn't quite know where they, you know, what exactly his you know, his realm was, or his you know, what was Nagilim? What was he capable of?
Yeah, right.
Is he corporeal? Is he? What does he do? What does he get up to during the day? A lot of this stuff was unanswered. And actually, I'm in reality though, it was nothing. You know, the episode was nothing really to do with that, right? It was just it was a threat that was put there. There was a very alien threat, and they didn't, in my mind, they didn't need to go into the into detail about who he was and why he was. And it was, to me, it was a nice construct on which you could actually have these questions of of death and of other things to bounce off. So I'm actually relatively happy, and I didn't particularly mind that there wasn't a huge amount of information on this dude, and the fact that he didn't come back again, it didn't really bother me.
Okay.
By the way, I do like the fact that Picard thinks he's in the hole still, and that basically just being tricked, which then can open up the theory that, hey, maybe they never got out. Maybe the entirety of the next gen from this point forward is just inside Nagidim's realm.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Okay, well, that's pretty much all I got, unless you have more.
No. I think I got to the end of that one.
Okay. All right. Well, then, it's now time to give our final thoughts and ratings for this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being poo-poo and 5 being the best of both worlds. I'm very tossed about this episode. In some ways, I don't know. I still think it kind of stinks. It's devoid of much of a storyline, but it's an interesting rats in a maze puzzle, as Pulaski put it. But still, it's kind of boring. It's not as bad as living on the terraforming planet. But it's... I just don't have anything spectacular. Having Haskell get killed for no reason was silly. It was sad. But especially the actor that played Haskell, I thought, did awesome. The fear in his eyes as he was dying was just spectacular. So, anyway, my thoughts and ratings are going to be very brief. I'm giving this one a 2 in the end. I'm sorry, Ben. You just can't pull a 5 out of this. Not a chance. But we'll see what the doctor says. Doc?
By the way, this is interesting. And I would actually really like to know what other people think about this, because let me give you my rating first, because I'm coming in at a 4 on this one. I kind of liked it. I liked it a lot. I liked the setup. I liked the atmosphere. I liked, and have to acknowledge the kind of impact it had on me when I watched it. I think it's an episode that, I know this is somewhat self-fulfilling and you shouldn't always rely on it, but in a way, this is kind of like I can't imagine this being anything other than Star Trek, in a way. Now, I know that at a certain point you say, well, yeah, but if you can't imagine anything other than Star Trek being Star Trek, then you're just reinforcing your like for Trek. But I do think that the way they handled this was in a way that was very unique. I liked it's not a profound episode. I mean, I think that's... Well, actually, maybe that's not even the right way to say it. It's not a big episode that you need to watch that is somehow going to change anything. It's not the big baddies. It's not going to change the flow of like a season-long story arc. It's a very spooky kind of mystery episode where they get into a... It's a slight anomaly of the week, although we're only in season 2. They find something that is not what you've had had before. You're able to ask some relatively serious questions within the construct that they put together. It's a spooky construct, and I think it kind of keeps the tension pretty high, and it's got a memorable kind of bad guy. So I was very happy watching it. It's not the greatest episode in the world, but I felt I felt more than happy to be watching and was kept entertained throughout. I hate Pulaski, and I think that the way that she bullies Data is horrible.
Yeah.
But I think, by the way, one of the things that where I'm coming from on this is that when I was growing up watching TNG, I related to Data. I was Data, and I felt that he was the character that we were supposed to relate to. We're supposed to see it through his eyes. Certainly growing up watching Trek, I was probably as innocent as Data and stuff. And I didn't know why this character came in and didn't see that Data was a great innocent person that was, you know, there was 100% good, and so that's why I don't like Pulaski in this. Okay. But yeah, I quite like, yeah, I do like this.
Okay.
But I do see also your point. Sorry, I do see your point, Lou, and it's not, you know, it's not spectacular in a way. So it'll be interesting to see where other people come in on this, because I suspect that, you know, you're right. This isn't going to be too tightly at either one end or another. It's not exactly best of both worlds, and it's not exactly justice. So I'm sure it will be very polarizing.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. All right. Well, then, I guess that's it.
Next time on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
I accept your challenge, Doctor.
I wouldn't miss it.
Dr. Pulaski challenges Data to solve the Sherlock Holmes mystery in the holodeck.
There is your killer. Seize her!
But the evil Moriarty seizes the ship's computer.
The time for games is over.
In a ruthless plot to sabotage the Enterprise on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Join us next week as we review episode 3 of season 2, Elementary, Dear Data. I am Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
And thank you for downloading. Good night.
Good night, everyone.